This is Elizabeth Anderson. Welcome to Second Saturday of the 10th Voice, which is always the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. And we have a very exciting show for you today. We're going to be talking about Mark Siegel's And Then I Danced for LGBT History Month. And my guests today are, as I'm looking at them, John Long, Holly Baggett, John Du Bois, and Rodney Wilson. And it's an illustrious panel. I'll let them all describe their backgrounds. But first, I wanted to talk about this being a pledge drive, a couple of things. And first, I had asked a few weeks ago for any comments on the 10th Voice, anyone who listened to it, anyone who had found it. And this one post, a comment from a listener moved me deeply. I'll just read it. The 10th Voice saved me when I was young and coming out. I remember listening to it on a super low volume with my ear against the speaker, afraid my parents would hear what I was listening to and know I was gay. The 10th Voice was more than a radio program. It was a reminder that I wasn't alone and that it would ultimately get better. To this day, I try to listen to it whenever I get a chance. It is always timely, informative, and entertaining. And that was from a young woman named Catherine. And I know this is true because I was at a local university years ago, probably, 11 years ago. And I saw a young woman who was very distraught on the library steps. And I recognized her from our LGBT community center, and I said, "What's going on?" And she told me that she felt very alone, that nobody on campus was LGBT, that she didn't feel like anybody else, she didn't want to be there. And I talked to her at length, and I finally said, "You know, if you feel this way and it's getting to you, I want you to go up and talk to my ex-husband. He teaches here, and he'll talk to you and he'll listen." Then I went up to his office and said, "By the way," and he said, "Sure, I'll be glad to." And even though he wasn't LGBT, just knowing that there was someone who would talk was a help. And so I happen to know that this comment is absolutely authentic. You might be aware that we had a lesbian bookstore here in town called Phoenix Books, and that's where I felt most safe when I came out in the early 90s. And it was first, I found it first on 39th Street and then on Westport Road. We had a women's music festival for 40 years nationally, Michigan Women's Music Festival. It's gone. It had its last year. There's a news site that I went to frequently, or if I wanted to find out about a celebrity or a book, and it was called After Ellen. It just had its last, post. The straight owner says he's keeping it, but the truth is it's just going to be a morgue. It's an archive of old articles, and he says he's using freelancers. All the freelancers say they've not been contacted. So I think we know, as LGBT people, what that means. When something like that goes away, it doesn't come back. I could give a lot more examples, but the truth is, today is tomorrow's history. And there are a number of ways, if you want to know how you could make a difference as an ally or as an LGBTQIA person, there are a couple ways. One is connected to this show. It's called the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. Sandra was a local author. She was very involved in the history of lesbian literature. And she was working with Mary Ann K. Martin on this project. Her wife, Cheryl Pletcher, has taken up the reins with Mary Ann. They're working together, and the Legacies of Lesbian Literature project is underway. There have already been interviews for a documentary that were done at the Golden Crown Literary Society with Lee Lynch and Jewel Gomez, and there will be others. And so one way you could support history and lesbian history is to give to the Legacies of Lesbian Literature Project. There's a CrowdRise site, there's a Facebook page, and you could find it that way. You can find out more information from the 10th Voice page, the Sandra Moran main page, or today's event page. I will post some links. If you can't give today, to keep the 10th Voice on the air, would you write or post a note of support? Because sometimes we wonder if anyone's listening. Constructive feedback is always welcome. Like, can you talk slower? You can volunteer in the community. There's the Like Me Lighthouse next door. There's an AIDS walk that is huge locally. There are many projects. You could join. There's the Mid-America Freedom Band, Heartland Men's Chorus, Kansas City Women's Chorus. There are drum circles. If you walk or run, there are the front runners. There are LGBT art exhibits, books, plays, gatherings. And the 10th Voice is one place you can hear about all those things. So, and you can always just walk up to someone and say, hi, I think you and I have something in common. And inevitably you do. But, you know, try to make connections. I want to ask now, before we move on to the book, because we're talking about pledging and supporting the 10th Voice, John Long is a publisher of Camp Magazine for 13 years now. And why is the 10th Voice important?
Thanks, Elizabeth. Yeah, I think, well, we've been publishing Camp for 13 years, and throughout the entire time we've been publishing, the 10th Voice has been out there reporting over the radio what we do in print. And I think it's one of the most valuable programs that I can think of. Where else can you find an hour's worth of really good conversation and something you can learn from locally? And not only is it local, but Elizabeth tells me that by streaming, you can find we have people listening in Europe and many other countries. So you can tell all your friends in other cities, especially people who might move to Palm Springs or some other city and leave us behind. Tell them to listen. You know, they can stay in touch with Kansas City by listening at kkfi.org. And but also, it's a way to showcase the LGBTQ community in Kansas City to other cities.
Thank you, John. And John, you moved here in February. What has the 10th Voice meant to you?
February because of the public radio app and streaming on KKFI.org. I listened to Woman Song and 10th Voice for perhaps up to a year, I think, before I moved here. And to me, it signaled that Kansas City is a good place to be. Mm-hmm. And I listen now because I need to know the news of my community. But even when I wasn't in this community, I enjoyed hearing about the goings-on and the importance of featuring local people and what they're doing. And, of course, the importance of featuring good books and good literature on the Sandra Rand Book Club.
And if you do want to give today, please call in. We'll be glad to acknowledge you on the air if you would like that. And the number is 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. Anyone who makes a pledge of $50 and would like a copy of Mark Siegel's And Then I Dance that we're talking about, I will mail it to you. So just make sure we have your address, and I will mail you a copy so you donate to the support the show and receive a copy. Also, I will match any pledges up to a total of $100. So even if you give $10, you know, 10 pledges of $10, I'll match it. Let's talk to the panel now and get started on the book. So I'm going to start with a gentleman to my left, Rodney Wilson. Rodney, would you tell a little about yourself and why LGBT history is important to you?
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you today. I've listened to a few of the programs, too, via podcasting, and so getting the opportunity to be here is really appreciated. I've been in education now for 27 years, and back in the 1990s, when I was a high school teacher over in St. Louis, I noticed that students did not have the opportunity in my class or in any class or via the textbooks to learn about the history of LGBT people. And so in 94, I got together with my friend John DeHere on my left and began to talk to her about the idea of an LGBT History Month that would very much mirror Women's History Month or Black History Month. She was actually the first person to read the initial proposal that I put together. So I believe in the power and importance of history for all people, for all groups and subgroups and subcultures. I think it's by learning history that we learn how to stand on the shoulders of others and to strengthen ourselves. So the fact that now here the 23rd annual LGBT History Month is still with us and widely celebrated across the country and in lots of colleges is really important to me. So the opportunity to be here during October makes this especially a nice occasion, and to have Jonda here with me doubles that.
Jonda? Thank you. I can't really add much to that amazing overview. I would just say that specifically I enjoy not just reading about or learning about our predecessors in activism, but as individuals, but also the events that they witnessed, the difficulties they had, the successes they had. And often it's the successes that surprise me the most, actually. You know, for example, in the book, talking about working with Republican administrations and being successful on that. So I think LGBT history is important to know that there were queer people, which is my umbrella term at the moment for all of us, who went before us for centuries, but also that our movement is important and worth studying.
And you put your money where your mouth is, because your job is?
I work at Legal Aid, helping indigent people in the western part of Missouri, and certainly helping to make my organization and my profession recognize LGBT people as well. But in general, just working for people who need a leg up in life.
And this show is all about giving people a voice. So, Holly, what about you?
Well, I'm a professor of American history, and my field of specialization is women in American history, and all of my research and publications have been in LGBT history. And when I started working on my dissertation, concentrating on women's history in the 80s, women's history had just been solidified fairly recently as a recognized, scholarly, rigorous subfield of history. So that was a little, the only person I could study with was somebody who had been hired as the wife of a male professor who got the tenure track job, and she was given a per course, and she was the only person I could go and study with, and she was great. And I decided to write my dissertation on two women named Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap, who established an avant-garde literary magazine in Chicago in 1914, and they were out lesbians. And in 1915, Margaret Anderson wrote the first editorial by a lesbian for gay rights, and got into all sorts of trouble about it. So that was my foundation in research, and then I've gone on to teach. I've been a teacher for 25 years, and as I'm teaching American history, it was clear to me that my students, LGBT students, were hungry, hungry, hungry for knowing something about their past and putting themselves within the context of that past. And so more and more as time went on, I was able to incorporate that. And it was important to me as an activist on the campus of Missouri State University. We were dealing with a lot of very unpleasant things, and we decided to have an observation. I was the advisor of the student group of Gay and Lesbian History Month to make a political point and to have a higher profile. And so for me, it's not just an educational vehicle, it's a political vehicle as well. And for students and young people to be able to sort of put their teeth into understanding where their past come from and how to make a usable past, as historians call it, to relate to contemporary issues as well. It's been a really powerful combination.
And your point about politics in conjunction with education is certainly an important one. John, how about you?
As I mentioned earlier, I've published CAMP since 2004. I founded the magazine with my then partner, Jim Gable, at the time. And we felt that we needed a news publication for the city. And that's given me a great connection to so many people I never would have met otherwise, so many groups I never would have met otherwise. And that's been a real privilege to be a reporter and basically make history in Kansas City. Stuart Hines is our wonderful director of the GLAMA Museum here in Kansas City, Gay and Lesbian Archives. And he wrote a piece in this current issue, the November issue of CAMP, the October issue of CAMP, that I encourage everyone to read, documenting a lot about our history. And that meant a lot to me because I grew up in Chicago. I came out as an adult after college in Chicago, not to my family, but to myself. Moved to San Francisco, arrived there the year after Harvey Milk was murdered. And there was still quite a bit of sadness even then, a year later. That was my welcome to San Francisco. And then, of course, I was there as so many of us experienced the AIDS crisis in the 80s. And then I lived in Washington, D.C. after I left San Francisco and then moved to Kansas City 20 years ago. So from my perspective, I know a lot of history around the country and in Kansas City. Reading Mark Siegel's book reminded me of so much of that. And I think for all the readers, you'll experience that. I mean, I can't say that I've done camp alone. We've had a treasure trove of writers and advertisers who supported the magazine and our readers. We've had so many writers over 13 years that have come and gone and contributed. And as one writer has told me, he'd rather sit there at his computer and write a story as his way of volunteering to give back to the computer community than go to a meeting on a Wednesday night. So we've had people who really look at writing as a form of activism.
And let's move to the book now, if that's all right. One of the things that impressed me the most was this wasn't someone who started activism in, say, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
He was an early activist, not just in terms of his own life, but in terms of the LGBT movement. Rodney, your reaction to that?
Yes. It was interesting to me. I almost felt he was a Forrest Gump type character in that he seemed to show up everywhere. He finished high school, I think, in May of 69 and then took off to New York under some false pretense with his parents, but just happened to be there in June of 1969 at the Stonewall Inn, the night of the raid. He took off quite early and wasn't there with the big part of the raid that night, but the next few nights he and others helped organize individuals to come down there. And finally, as he put it, in standing up to the police, they were also standing up to all of the institutions in society that had kept him and people like him down. And then just last week, or this week, for the first time ever, a presidential candidate, in this case Secretary Clinton, has written an op-ed that appeared in an LGBT newspaper, and it's his LGBT newspaper that he founded 40 years ago. So all of these years he has been in and out of this particular advancement and this movement toward full equality for all Americans. So it was an incredible read, and to see him turning up here and turning up there and always being around the story, it was amazing that he was able to stay connected to the community and now has been for 45 years.
And Holly?
Yeah, what I think was interesting, because you really see this kind of story happen a lot, is he just sort of walked backwards into this situation. And he was and is what Candace Gingrich, Newt's half-sister, who worked with the Human Rights Campaign, wrote a book called Accidental Activist. And I think that's what's happened to an awful lot of us. You know, you're just going about your life, your job, school, and then you find yourself walking into this situation. It's just so unreal and absurd that you feel you have to do something about it. And then the next thing you know, the entire trajectory of your life is going down this road. You didn't plan it.
Mm-hmm.
But once he walked into that situation, he obviously just grabbed it by the horns and has been going ever since.
And there was something, and I'd love your comments on this, that he said in the book. He had long hair. He didn't have a lot of money, so his clothes were frequently rumpled and threadbare. And as some of the organizations got a little farther along, they were of the mind, you know, if you lesbians would just put on a dress and you gay men would just put on a suit and look nicer, you'd be more accepted. And obviously that's not the road he took, and he was very successful. Jonda?
Yes, I did find that interesting. Also, I want to say that his activism in the late 60s and early 70s was, in a sense, a reaction to the same people wearing the pencil skirts and the pencil ties and marching at the mm-hmm. annual reminder. So it wasn't a new thing necessarily, but the gentrification of the movement was probably like deja vu to him. He talks about having come out of the Mattachine Society office with a comrade in arms, Marty Robinson, that he kept for years and years because those were old guys. They were crusty. Their brand of activism wasn't going to work for them. And it's funny that it came back around that his generation was wearing the polo shirt and living in the fancy houses and not sure how to handle consensus building or how to handle you know, issues. Now, in the end, he ends up working for the poor in his housing project, his LGBT senior housing project. He comes back around after a fabulous career and wonderful lifestyle to working for people whose housing required them to make less than $33,000 a year, and that's, I think, I believe, a 2015 number.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here he was a young Turk, and now he's my age. And so, as you said, Rodney, he graduated from high school in 1969. And toward the end of the book, he says, I realized, oh, my gosh, I'm not the young gay, you know, activist. In my heart, I am. But I'm... John?
Well, you know, one of the things that I reminded myself of a statement that we used to use quite often years ago. And it was, gay is a movement, not a market. And this book summed that up for me in many ways, because Mark Siegel sacrificed a lot, as did many of the pioneers. We weren't always, as John has said, this, you know, buttoned up A-list group of people. The Pride festivals were incredibly political, and they weren't necessarily a place to drink and wave rainbow flags necessarily. And it was a movement, and of course it was called the Gay Liberation Movement in the beginning. And I think the chapter in the book that tells a lot is the Stonewall chapter. And Mark talks about the people who had actually done political activity before Stonewall. And that Stonewall was not just a one-night affair. And John, you had made a fun remark about the Judy Garland connection that Mark had talked about.
I found it interesting that he felt like he needed to address the idea that the Stonewall riots were because of Judy Garland's death and funeral at that time. His comment in the book, and we've decided that we're not worrying about any spoiler alerts, is that...
this plot has already occurred.
Yes. Is that it was far more political than that. That was almost dismissive of their anger and activism, because these were younger folks who weren't as invested in Judy Garland as maybe their forefathers were, but also to not dismiss the fact that they were reacting with pure rage at all the oppressive forces in their lives, not to the death of an icon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good example of accidental activism. You know, they just had it. They had boiled over. And when he chained himself to the camera, I am his age, and I remember how important Walter Cronkite was across mm-hmm. the country.
Right.
And when he said, I wanted them to see a gay man on camera, and he actually, he had plotted out like a well, you know, planned maneuver, and he did it, and there was a gay man on camera, and it was a shock nationwide. What about some of his other attempts to get recognition? In what ways do you think he was most successful?
Well, he was on the Phil Donahue show, and in fact, he brought his parents, who had been very supportive of him, and that was a very historic move for people at the time.
Phil Donahue, I remember watching him while my mother was ironing clothes.
Right.
And she loved him because he was so gentle, and he had nice people on his show. So to have nice people mm-hmm. who were Jewish people with a gay son,
yeah.
that was a landmark.
And the Donahue show was subversive because he did come across as a nice individual, well-informed, respectful of his audience, yet many of his topics were quite subversive for the day. So Phil Donahue took a great risk in that program, and it was interesting that Mark was able to be on that show. And then the zap that he did at the Mike Douglas show, also there with, I think, Tony Bennett and Helen Hayes were having a foot massage or something when he chained himself to that camera. I mean, this is brave activism. This is making a point. This is trying to create some sort of crisis. You know, it's political theater. And yet it gave him a position from that point, a position of people being aware of who he was, and it gave him a platform to begin from that point to start talking about things in a way that maybe weren't quite as outrageous. I don't expect that he would be chaining himself to anything these days, yet he's still very active, as John mentioned, in this senior housing for LGBT people that I just think is tremendous. It's really followed the trajectory of his career, because he started as an 18-year-old in a bar in New York, and and now he's a 65-year-old, and he's thinking about housing for elderly LGBT people who don't have the funds necessary to live where they might want to live.
And I think it's one of the really interesting things in the book is he gives you a behind the scenes what the reactions of the people were that he zapped, Walter Cronkite and the Today Show, Barbara Walters, and he talks about Phil Donahue and how Donahue interacted with him and his family. So it's really interesting to see what these people off the camera in private and how supportive they were. And also, I just want to interject in terms of we're talking about generational differences, and you know, as I look around the table, I think everybody here is over 25, and we've all gone on that journey of being young and dramatic ourselves, and then thinking, you know, maybe it's time to get a little more invested within the system if we really want to make a difference. And I do think in his case, I mean, he had a strategy for what the times required. Zapping was a strategy that was required at that time. But as he's gone on, and he talks about his involvement in the Philadelphia political system, working with mayors, working with governors, etc., and he's starting to get laws passed, I think that was really his biggest impact.
Mm-hmm. Shonda? I just wanted to add that for readers and listeners that he got arrested repeatedly for these things as we're talking about his young activism, and he got a rough ride repeatedly in the back of a police van for these things. And
I called it a nickel ride.
Yeah. Yes. And so I do not think that he was, you know, treated with kid gloves just because he was famous and becoming more famous. He was treated very roughly as he was pulling these zaps, as he called these publicity and activism stunts. And his parents, I just have to stop and say, you know, being so supportive of him had to have made a huge difference in his willingness to be basically unemployable while doing these things, and being willing to go to jail over and over and over again. Literally, like every 6 weeks, he's doing a zap and going to jail and getting a rough ride.
And I want to mention here, it's just a slight diversion, that Black Lives Matter, he knew he wasn't going to be killed. He was pretty certain he wasn't going to be killed. What was going to happen was he was going to get this nickel ride where his hands are handcuffed behind his back, and they take as many potholes and bumps as possible, so he's thoroughly bruised. But then he's going to get bailed out, and he's going to do it again. So at least he was very, very brave, and he was very, very brash. But I don't think he thought he was, you know, committing suicide by doing this. So mm-hmm. I just want to make that point.
And he was at such a young age that one can take a risk and maybe lose something. In this case, he did have his parents backing him, and that extraordinary grandmom, as he called her, who had been a suffragette, who took him to a civil rights demonstration. So he had that, you know, within his DNA and within his family culture. And they were standing behind him and taking care of him fiscally until he could reach a point at which he could continue with the activism, but in a way that he could also begin to support himself financially with the newspaper endeavor.
Mm-hmm. I thought also, up till now, until I read his book, there's been so many books focused, when it comes to history, about the AIDS epidemic. And I was thinking about in the band played on by Randy Schultz, and in AIDS Memoir by Paul Monette, and you know, even when we read books about the life and times of Harvey Milk, so much of it is still focused on the AIDS crisis, which was such a terrible, very sad part of our history. So we can't deny that that was a very important part. Mark's book talks about that, of course, but he talks about all the other groundbreaking parts of history that we made in terms of politics and getting laws passed and getting recognition. It's I think for many people who didn't experience this time or these decades, it's tremendously informational.
And we're going to pause to thank a few people and give a phone number where they can call in and listen to a song. And then we're coming back. Nobody go away, because we have lots more to discuss. We're talking about Mark Siegel's And Then I Danced for LGBT History Month this month. And I want to thank Michelle Pond, who is a regular listener of The Tenth Voice and Woman Song in the Book Club from Overland Park, Kansas. Lee Hartman, of the Mid-American Freedom Band, and Ace Trivia Person, and he's called in from Kansas City. And we were discussing in the green room Bob Miner, and Dr. Robert Miner has called in. And he has been a panelist on the book club for Julia Allen's Passionate Commitments. And he listens to both Tenth Voice and Woman Song. So thank you, all of you, and let's hear a song, and we're coming back. This is Elizabeth Anderson, and it's the book club, Santa Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. We are talking about Mark Siegel's And Then I Danced. It is a pledge drive. We have had some pledges, but if you would like to show your support for the show, you can call in to 888-931-0901. Or if you're on your computer or phone, we do live stream the show, and you can contribute at kkfi.org. And now we're going back to the book. So let's talk a little. We were talking just now about politics in the book. It was interesting toward the end of the book about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Would someone care to explain that portion of the book, Jonda?
Okay. The 2008 contest is the backdrop, of course, when they were at that point both vying for the nomination. And, President Obama failed to respond to a request by the Philadelphia Gay News to answer interview questions. Senator Clinton, on April 4th, 2008, the front page of the Philadelphia Gay News was filled on the right side with the interview with Senator Hillary Clinton. The entire left half of the front page was a blank space, with the exception of a box in the middle that read, "It's been 1,522 days since Senator Barack Obama has spoken with local gay press. See editorial, page 11. They got tired of waiting on him, and so they zapped him. In essence, this is a zap 40 years after he stopped zapping every 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Against the president. Now, he does go on to talk about President Obama's addresses to the gay community, President Obama and Mrs. Obama's support of the LGBT community, including taking an interest in his low-income gay seniors housing project from the White House, which is certainly laudable, but I appreciate his throwing them into relief in April of 2008.
And I did understand that as a potentially first black president, Barack Obama had to be careful. But he had 18 months, he said, of committing to LGBT events and then not showing up.
Right. And Mark brought up the fact that even when he was speaking to Mark in 2008, he said he was in favor of civil unions but had not come out in support of gay marriage at that point.
And also, I remember Mark made the point about the importance of local media, that there was a small newspaper when Barack Obama was running for state senate in Illinois that sent a questionnaire that included the issue of marriage equality. And at that point, President Obama, well, then not even State Senator Obama, mm-hmm. said he supported it. And someone was able to dig that out of an archive because of a small local LGBT newspaper. So there was definitely that dance occurring in 2008, where I always felt in his heart of hearts, President Obama favored marriage equality. But at that time, in order to get elected, he could not quite say that.
Really? Right, and you know, I have a great deal of respect for President Obama, but his constant statement in his early presidency that he was evolving on this issue really got under my skin, because I knew about that when he was running in Illinois, Chicago as a state, he had said he was, and if you read his books, it's clear. He has a lot of friends, and it's clear on that. So that just really kind of riled me when he was always saying he was evolving. First of all, he's too smart to be evolving on something like this. And let's face it, what brought him out of the closet, if you want to put it that way, was Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Good old Joe. I'm from the state of Delaware. I've voted for him all my life, and you know, he just comes out and says it, and he's been that way going way back. And that's what prompted Obama to finally say that. And I wonder how long it would be. I'm sure he would have gotten around to it. But I have a former colleague, Lita Black. We were teaching together at the University of Delaware, and she went on to Washington, D.C. to edit the Eleanor Roosevelt papers. And she became Hillary Clinton when she was first lady, came and talked and tried to raise money for the Eleanor Roosevelt papers. And so she got to, Lita got to know Hillary that way. And Lita's been in a very long-term relationship. And from her, you can also get the inside story that Hillary, of course, because in her public pronouncements as well, when they were running in that primary, she wasn't. I'm all for it. She was careful, but it's clear as well where they both were, and they felt they had to be somewhat politically expedient. And this is what always puts us in a bind. Do we support these people anyway, even they're willing kind of to sacrifice us? But we know in our heart of hearts, and once they get in there, they're going to be our, you know. It's this constant thing we go through around and around again and again. But it was a really interesting aspect of this book.
Is my memory correct that prior to the 2012 election, though, in that Robin Roberts interview, President Obama did say he had now fully evolved and supported marriage equality prior to the 2012 election?
No, that interview was right after Joe Biden said his thing.
But it was before the election, though, in 2012, wasn't it? I'm not sure my memory is serving me correctly, because I always sort of, I think it was, and so for me, that redeemed him completely on that issue, that prior to the 2012 re-election campaign, he did say
to the American
people,
timing's right.
I do support marriage equality.
Right. Well, what was he going to do with good old Joe?
And of course,
you have to love Joe Biden, because he's, and people who know him, in Delaware, we have three counties. You cannot avoid your politicians. Everywhere you go, there they are. And that's the way we knew him in Delaware. He says what he thinks, and sometimes he gets his allies in trouble.
And once the Supreme Court made the decision, it made easier for politicians.
Right. What are you going to do?
They no longer have to say we're evolving.
That was interesting. The Republican, I think, governor in Pennsylvania. And Mark Siegel gave him, I think, four options. Here's what you can do. You can bump it to the state treasurer and say tax implications. You can bump it to the state attorney. Or you could go the Chris Christie route in New Jersey and go ahead and accept it. And here, after Mark gave the governor the options, he hears he's going the Chris Christie route. That's pretty impressive networking.
Right. Yeah. You know, in reading this book, too, there really is something for everyone, young and old, political or not political. I mean, he talks about the Elton John concert that he brought to Philadelphia and as a big, huge fundraiser and all that that took. I mean, I can't even imagine, if you're not a concert organizer, what that might have taken, especially when you have someone like Elton John and his friendship with Patti LaBelle, Philadelphia's own, and how she supported this.
And then she's mad because he won't sing a duet.
Right.
Sure.
And everything about picture taking with Elton when he was refusing, and Mark had to say, no, it's part of your contract. You have to take pictures with people. And so part of that was in some ways humorous and fun. And there's the parts about his family, as John just spoke about. The whole first chapter is about his family, and it's very poignant. And then the part, of course, where he meets his love, who's now his husband, many years younger, which is also sometimes controversial for people. And I think that's a large part of the name of the book, and Then I Danced. He also talks about his breakdown, and that's an important part of the book. He's very honest about that. So.
Well, certainly I think we've all seen in movies and read in books and know people where LGBT relationships have been under a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe one partner's out, the other's not. Maybe because of a job, you know, one can be more out than the other. And his breakdown was in large part caused by his partner of 20 years. He found out he didn't really know him. And he had cheated on him, and he had HIV. Mark was petrified, and he was out of the country in Jerusalem, I believe, mm-hmm. and came back and got tested. But it was just all too much on top of everything that he was doing. One of the advantages he had was he was smart to move to New York City, and he was in on the ground floor of the Gay Liberation Front, and then he came back to Philadelphia and was in the Gay Activists Alliance. It's interesting because we're getting the perspective of a very East Coast major city, particularly the Northeast. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you've got Harvey Milk on the West Coast. What was going on here in the middle?
Well, the thing I thought of when I was reading the book is ACT UP. Mm-hmm. And I know many people, including my good friend Missy Coons, who everyone knows as an actor and director in town, and she was very involved with ACT UP. And these were protests that had people laying in the street called die-ins to get attention for AIDS awareness and money. And unfortunately, the government was slow to respond under the Reagan administration. And there was some real activism. There were also the condom crusaders who would go bar to bar with baskets of condoms and just, you know, emphasizing safe sex, safe sex. And there was a lot of activism right here in the Midwest, as in all the other cities as well.
Rodney?
Mark also talks about Reverend Troy Perry, who was organizing the Metropolitan Community Church beginning in about 1969. And the difficulties in terms of religion and the LGBT community and beginning to formulate some sort of trust with religious leaders. But speaking of what was going on in the Midwest, that then reminds me of Carol Curitan, who in October 1973 started a Metropolitan Community Church in St. Louis, which really became the community center and the focus of the LGBT community in St. Louis. She was from Poplar Bluff, Missouri, very young, just out of college, and did some extraordinary work. So there were all sorts of unsung heroes everywhere at the time who were doing incredible work, not just in big urban areas or east or west coast cities.
Elizabeth, John mentioned Stewart's article in this month's mm-hmm. camp, but I don't think we said, you know, that there are important events coming up in the middle of October to commemorate the fact that Kansas City was on the forefront
right.
of LGBT rights.
On the 16th, the 18th, and the 20th.
Right, where there's going to be specific events, especially on the 20th. In Mark Siegel's book, he talked about the marker that was established. I'm not sure if it was Stonewall Inn he was talking about, or there was another location where they put a marker to commemorate a particular issue.
I think it was the annual reminders in Philadelphia.
That's it. And so we're going to have the same similar situation with on October 20th. We're going to have a permanent marker installed in the northeast corner of Barney Alice Plaza. The details you can find them on camp.lgbt in Stuart Hines' story, or in the print edition that's out.
And we had major meetings here in Kansas
right.
City.
The marker commemorates.
At that time, it was called the Homophiles.
Yeah.
I know at one point.
I like that word. We should use it more often.
The marker commemorates the meeting in January of 1966 of organizations from across the U.S., because Kansas City's in the middle, of homophile organizations, political organizations, and a few months later, the founding of the Phoenix Society mm-hmm. in Kansas City. Note, folks, 3 years before Stonewall, activism in Kansas City on gay and queer issues.
And you know, we talk about the Philadelphia Gay News that Mark founded, but in all the cities, there were publications like the Phoenix newsletter, and these were typewritten. The Washington Blade was called the Gay Blade, and these were typewritten, photocopied newsletters, cut and paste, you know, long before we had the technology we have now.
Well, and a lot of people aren't aware that women's music, lesbian music, was very activist in the 70s and 80s and early 90s and still is. More people are aware of it, but also there were lesbian publications, and they were mailed out, they were mimeographed, they were handed out. And
you can see those at the Glamour Museum. Mm-hmm. Stuart Hines has shown those specific magazines to me.
Holly, do you have anything you want to mention here in terms of how lesbians got the word out to each other on how things were happening?
That's true. I think there was a lesbian culture, and there's even an aspect called cultural feminism that was really prominent in the 70s and 80s, and particularly with record labels like Olivia. During your break there, I believe you were playing Holly Near. I haven't heard her for a long time. That was very nice. But in terms of the writing of lesbian history, it has been a struggle because a lot of the first studies that came out about big cities and organizations in big cities and hierarchical organizations in big cities. But, you know, coming back to this book and about Philadelphia, there is a scholarly study of Philadelphia called The City of Brotherly and Sisterly Love from 1945 to 1972. And the author of that, Mark Stein, was a graduate student of a woman named Carol Smith Rosenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. That was his dissertation. And she published an article in 1974 called The Female World of Love and Ritual, in which she studied letters back and forth between women over decades. And she was the person who coined the phrase romantic friendship, and really lesbian history just took off from there. Then you have Lily and Fetterman's The Passing of the Love of Men, and now you just have an explosion of literature out there. It's hard to keep up with it, to tell you the truth.
And Bonnie Morris has
right.
just written a book, The Disappearing L Word, I believe.
Yeah, and Bonnie Morris is, as I'm sure Jonda knows, and she's such a fan of women's music festivals. Her career has been established on writing the history of women's music festivals, if anybody out there is interested.
She has a book, Eden Built by Eves. And in fact, I have it in my trunk of my car right now. It's on my list to read. And what I found interesting about his book, too, was from the earliest days, it was LGBT, because there were trans people who were, you know, they were on the streets, they were impoverished, and they were the ones who started the first protests, you know, along with drag queens. And you had lesbians swinging in, and it was interesting how all the letters were there at the beginning.
They may not have called it that or used all the letters,
right.
but I appreciated how he highlighted the specific circumstances of transgender folks and as well as drag queens. And
I think it's also important to say that gay was very inclusive. When we said gay liberation, it wasn't spelled out like it is today, but it was inclusive.
And I want to stop to thank a couple of people who have pledged. Thank you so much for your support of the show. Carolyn Finkendove, who is a great friend. She's been a volunteer at the Lighthouse, and she's a former president, along with her husband, Glenn, of PFLAG, the Kansas City chapter. And she would like Mark's book mailed to her, so Carolyn, it's coming your way. And Carol Kuhn from Leavenworth has called in and has pledged. So thank you very much. Again, that number is 888-931-0901, or you can pledge online at kkfi.org. What would you say is your most memorable scene in the book, if you had to pick one? I like what Rodney said about he was kind of Forrest Gump, because I think one of my most memorable scenes was when he's gotten married to Jason, and he's going to have a picture taken with Barack Obama. And he says, oh, I've had my picture taken with you. I want to stand by the first lady. But it's just, that to me encapsulated, you know, how President Barack Obama had changed, how the country has changed, how he had remarried. And, you know, here he is, a gay Jewish man at the White House. So, anyone else?
I thought one of the things, I think we've all been there, when he said he came out of the one gala and realized he had no way to get home, and that he and Jason were out in front knowing it was going to be a long walk home because they'd forgotten to, they'd gotten all the other arrangements right, but they forgot to get transportation for themselves. So,
I'm going to go with his, sorry, lost my place here. Someone else.
I think I was moved early on by the fact that he was raised in an impoverished family, living in a housing project, and how that makes one feel left out from the mainstream and can even engender shame. I was raised in a similar circumstance, so I could understand his point and how he also wrote near the end. He said, even though now I have some means, I have some circumstance that would protect me, I still always remember and I always recall what that was like. And somewhere deep down, I'm always afraid that that could happen to me again. And I've had similar feelings. So in those descriptions, it made me feel some sort of empathy and sympathy and simpatico, I guess, with him.
I'll speak about the consensus building scene. The scene where he's talking about how the organizations were trying to build consensus with scores of people in a room. It's a noble goal, and it was a vivid scene for me because I've been out and in the community for 25 years now, and it's important and it looks good on paper, and it's so difficult to do that I appreciated his mentioning that they gave it a shot and that it did, as it often does, really slow down any real decision-making or any forward movement. An important process, but there's a balance.
Holly?
Well, ironically, since this is a history of his activism, I really found the personal accounts about growing up and his family, and particularly his mother's illness and death, the ones that really touched you most profoundly. And I think if you make a connection between his personal experiences and his political ones, the fact that he did grow up in the projects of Philadelphia, you know, class is, we haven't touched on it that much, but class is a theme throughout this book. And as anybody who's been involved in any organization or any community know, class is a big, unfortunately, wedge between us. And every now and then he repeats this phrase again and again and again, those guys in the polo shirts with those funny animals on it. I mean, that comes out. And you can just see kind of like a tinge, or maybe even more of a tinge of bitterness there over class issues. And I think you see the connection between the personal and political there. But those were really, I thought the one scene where he's with Ed Rendell and Bill Clinton and he throws the camera to Ed Rendell, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, head of the Democratic National Committee. And I thought his treatment of Philadelphia politicians was that I thought he went easy on a lot of them. But Ed Rendell has always been out there in front and been a good guy from the first start. And the way he keeps popping up in a fun type of way, I like that.
And I saw his integrity when the senior center had received $500,000. But then Vincent was under investigation, I believe, by the FBI. And he didn't want to get caught up in anything in Pennsylvania politics, so he gave it back. Ed Rendell called and yelled at him. Or saw him and yelled at him and said, don't ever give back money. Remember, you're a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, told a lot about Mark's integrity. He thought, fine, I don't want tainted money. I'll give it back.
And, you know, the senior center, you can tell, is just a labor of love for him. If I was to talk to Mark, you know, personally right now, I'd ask him what he was most proud of, whether it was the founding of the Philadelphia Gay News or the founding of the senior center. And, you know, I wonder what his answer might be, because in the book he speaks so proudly of the center. It was named the John C. Anderson Center, Senior Center, because John C. Anderson was a former city council member who was both African-American and gay and who had died from AIDS. So I think he was honored to name the Senior Center after John C. Anderson. And he speaks in the book about since they've done this, scores of cities have been coming to see their center to get ideas of how they can do the same. And who knows, that could even happen in Kansas City at some point.
I think the senior center had its heart. And the paper, he knew, was critical. Mm-hmm. And he needed to keep it going. But he had a staff, and he was willing to delegate. So the paper was an incredible tool for him. But the senior center was a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And I just want to mention on this panel, it's interesting because I've known John for years. I've known John relatively recently and didn't know Holly or Rodney. But Rodney and John explained how they're connected with LGBT History Month. John and Holly are connected through Springfield. John and I are connected through publishing and journalism, and we talk a lot about editing. But then I found out that I went to high school in a tiny little town in Massachusetts in the Springfield area called Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Rodney, you lived there too. It's not very big and no one's heard of it.
Yes, I lived in Wilbraham. I lived in Massachusetts for 14 years, but in Wilbraham for 8 years, so that was quite a coincidence.
My parents lived there for 17 years, and that we'll have to talk after. But, yeah, that is one thing in reading this book that struck me over and over, was he always had his eye out for listening, for seeing, for... I love that term, accidental activism, that Holly used. He was able to do that because he took advantage of opportunities, and he made opportunities.
He made opportunities, yes.
So, any last thoughts? Because we're coming to the end of our time.
I would encourage everyone to read And Then I Danced by Mark Siegel, and then also go from what he discusses in the book to read other works, like read about Frank Kameny, read about Barbara Giddings. There's a new book by Tracy Baim about Barbara Giddings that we have on the table.
Who's also a publisher.
Yes, she is.
Windy City Times in Chicago.
Read John. Bonnie Morris's books. Read Lillian Faderman and Julia Morris. We had her book featured in March, Passionate Commitments. So there are plenty of books on LGBT, and John mentioned a few.
Yeah, and also the fact that this is a political year. It's a 300-page book. It's an easy read. It's perfect timing.
And while they occur throughout the year, this is Lesbian and Gay History Month. LGBT History Month, 23rd annual, the entire month, 31 days. And I know lots of cities and municipalities and colleges and even secondary schools are putting on various programs. So look those up wherever you might be and go out to those as well.
Is that website LGBT History, I believe, or...?
You can find LGBTHistoryMonth.com, but probably the best thing to do would be if you're in, let's say, Philadelphia, Google Philadelphia and LGBT History Month events, and you'll find a ton of them.
I want to thank my panelists, Rodney, Jonda, Holly, and John, and mention that at the end of this month, we're having a bonus book club. Very excited to announce that Jewel Gomez said we're welcome to feature her book, Gilda Stories, and it's going to be a Halloween special. And we do hope to have a taped interview. Michelle Carlsberg of New York City and I will interview Jewel for a segment on the show. Then in November, we're doing Sandra Moran's Letters Never Sent with a very illustrious panel, her longtime friend Rebecca Maurer, a former student and friend of hers, Matt, her wife, Cheryl Pletcher, her publisher, Salem West. It's going to be interesting. And then in December, we're doing Michael Cunningham's The Hours and Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf with Liz Hodge. And I'm blanking. Dr. William Stockton of Johnson County Community College. And it's going to be a great show. So you are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Please stay tuned for This Way Out.